Being a physician is hard. Being married is hard. I put these together, and life can sometimes get really hard. Unless, like in residency, we learn from the experts and try to do better. And today, we have one of those experts, an expert on physician marriage. Now, this is part one of two, so if you like it, make sure you check out next week's episode as well. Dr. Michael Myers is a professor of clinical psychiatry and recent past vice president of education and director of training in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at SUNY Downstate Health Sciences University in Brooklyn. He's a specialist in physician health and the author of many books, including most recent of which is called Physicians with Lived Experience, How Their Stories Offer Clinical Guidance. But the reason he's on today's episode is he also wrote Doctors' Marriages, A Look at the Problems and Their Solutions. He lectures widely throughout North America and beyond on common stresses of medical training and practice: burnout and moral injury, depression, substance use disorders, PTSD, marital discord, and more, and how stigma in the house of medicine works against symptomatic doctors receiving the care they deserve. And if you want to learn more, check him out at michaelfmyers.com. You're listening to Succeed in Medicine, the show for practicing physicians who want to master the parts of their career and life that med school never prepared us for. From interpersonal skills to career navigation to the essential information every physician needs. I'm Dr. Bradley Block, and in every episode, we bring you brass tacks advice and immediately applicable insights from world-class experts so you can feel prepared wherever your MD takes you and build a life in medicine that's sustainable, rewarding, and actually worth all those years of sacrifice. Dr. Michael Myers, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
So let's just get right to the meat of it, right? So when you see physician couples of not necessarily a dual physician marriage, but, you know, there's at least one physician in the relationship and they're having issues such that they need help, right? Yep. What are the most common problems that you see?
Yep. There are a few that stand out. Probably the one that grabs the attention most quickly is when and if a spouse has disclosed his or her partner spouse that they're having an affair. So that's a crisis. You know, that throws everybody into a complete thing. That's one. Another is the use of substances in a relationship that really does seem to be causing a lot of friction, a lot of tension. That's a third one is when and if there's been usually a single episode of violence. For instance, you know, there's just sort of come out of the blue. My husband struck me over the weekend. Or it might be him calling and saying, look, my wife and I need to see you. I lashed out on the weekend. This is not me. I really want help for the both of us or something like that.
Yeah.
And then the next one often sometimes has something to do with one of them being diagnosed with a substance use disorder. And how is that affecting the marriage? Or if it's not that, it could be that one of them has been diagnosed with depression or bipolar illness or something. And that's caused a sort of a disruption of the marital equilibrium. They really just, you know, want some guidance. And I'd say the last one has to do when there's a problem with the kids. So that something has happened and they're kind of both there as worried parents and wondering, is our child acting out because of problems at home? That type of thing.
So is that last one causing friction in the marriage? Is that because they're like not on the same page about how to manage that situation, or it's just causing stress for both of them? And then that in and of itself takes.
You can be both, right? Yeah. It can be a situation where perhaps the child or adolescent psychologist or psychiatrist has said, you know, I think your daughter's eating disorder might have something to do with what's going on with the two of you. And have you two thought of going for some help? So in that case, it's kind of a level playing field.
So these are all humongous issues, right? Infidelity, violence, substance use disorder, and then issues with the children.
Yeah.
So I'm not quite sure where to begin because, correct me if I'm wrong, if there's substance use disorder, that needs to be the thing that's addressed, right? Yeah. Like maybe in the context of the marriage, but the substance that needs to be addressed. If violence is an issue, that person's mental health is the thing that needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
Like, these don't strike me as a problem for the marriage so much as it that individual's issue
right.
that's taking its toll on the marriage.
Well, let me back up a bit and I'll tell you, why don't we kind of talk about something that's a little bit more run of the mill where a couple comes, says, you know, I'm kind of worried that we're drifting.
Yeah.
We haven't made love in 6 months. My husband's been working harder than usual. I've been working harder than usual. I'm kind of wondering if we're avoiding something. And at the bottom of this, I don't think we communicate very well. That type of thing. I'd be happy to start there because communication difficulties are the root of many of the things that, you know, I spit out when we first sat down.
Yeah, that would be a great place to start because I think for the listeners, right, like I said, if there's substance use, address the substance use. If there's violence, address the mental health.
Yeah.
If there's mental health that needs to be, right, you said bipolar disorder, address that. But I think like communication issues within the couple.
Yeah.
And then the infidelity, we can get back to that. But, you know, that seems to me like if we can address things before it gets to that.
Mm-hmm. I'm always very, very sympathetic to couples who are saying, you know, it's like we're on different planets or something.
Yeah.
We communicate very differently. And sometimes it's got to do with the fact that one's a man, one's a woman.
Yeah.
You know, in mixed couples, and sometimes if they're same sex couples where they're both of the same gender, but yet they're having problems communicating as well. Because most of us don't grow up with a sense of how to communicate effectively in your intimate relationships. Some people who have had really positive role models for parents, that helps a lot because they actually just learn that. They saw how effectively their own parents communicated. But those couples seem to sort of be in the minority.
Yeah.
Most will say, oh my gosh, no, my folks didn't communicate all that well. They remained together, but yet that was a different generation. Or others will say, well, my folks split when I was 12 and then they had relationships and then they broke up with those people, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Not a positive role model. Yeah.
No. It's also where they contrast with our communication in medicine. Because I remember one couple very clearly, the man was so offended that his wife felt that his communication skills were awful. And he brought in a plaque that he had been awarded by his residents that said, the best communicator of the year award.
Yeah, that hits home because a lot of my previous episodes are about optimizing physician-patient communication.
Yes.
And so I pride myself on my communication. I teach it to other physicians and to trainees. Yeah. And when my wife and I are having issues, I clam up and she's the one that instigates the communication and helps us move forward. So yes, I am a great communicator with my patients, but not so much with my wife.
Well, Brad, I think what we need to emphasize here is that a love relationship between two people who are committed to each other in marriage, that's one of our most sort of intimate and vulnerable relationships that we have in our life. And that's why sometimes even our communication expertise or experience outside the marriage can fail us.
Yeah.
And so, for instance, it was never unusual for me to look after couples who really felt, my God, I communicate so well with others, but in my marriage, I mean, I just strike out. That's the thing. And that's where a third party could really be very, very helpful. So, and I could just mention some of those things to you if you'd like that.
Yeah, please.
That kind of characterize a doctor's life. You know, because of the fact that I think it depends obviously with what's really what the doctor does, their type of work, that type of thing. But if we just sort of look at the fact, though, that doctors are generally pretty hard workers, a number of hours per week are spent in the workplace, that in itself can kind of tip over into a complicated relationship at home. When the spouse gets that, though, and understands that this is just the way it is, very thoughtful spouses and physicians themselves will say, okay, look, we need to really protect the time that we have together and the time that I'm not at work. And that can be very effective. In fact, I know many kids, for instance, who grew up in homes where their parents were very busy with their work. And yet they would describe their parents' marriage as really wonderful. They said, I wish I would have seen my dad more or my mom more or whatever. But, you know, that was the nature of their jobs. But I got to tell you, when they were home, we were their focus, or they focused on the relationship and made sure that they had dates together. You know, when we went on vacation, it was just wonderful, that type of thing. So with intention, you can really work on that very, very nicely.
And so actually, I have a colleague. He's got another podcast. His name is Michael Hirsch. He's a gastroenterologist. He's a physician coach. And one of the things he always talks about is leave your work at work and how to do it.
Yes.
So he helps people to do that, to leave their work at work. And so what would your advice be to people who get home and they're having trouble transitioning from the decisiveness, the rigor, the stress of work?
Yeah.
And maybe they need some distance, maybe they want to unravel, but they want to be fully present and give their family what they deserve. How do you do that?
Yeah, Brad, it's a very common issue. And it's sometimes it's as very real as the transit time. Like, for instance, if somebody's, they leave the hospital, leave their office or whatever, and they've got maybe a 30-minute or 40-minute, or depending on traffic or stuff like that, before they get home, that helps because they can unwind a little bit. If they're going by public transportation, they may do something completely different, listening to music, reading, or whatever. That helps to kind of leave the immediacy of the workplace.
Yeah.
Those individuals who kind of live right next door or very close, they do need transition time.
Okay.
Many of them will recognize, look, I need to go for a quick run, or I need to, you know, just have.
But we already feel guilty enough, right? We feel guilty enough that we've left, and now it feels like selfish that we're taking this time for ourselves. Like, I need to go for a run. I know I've spent this long time away, but now I need to do even more for myself.
Yes.
Right? It feels that way, and the optics are that way.
Well, except, though, you just said something key there, something like more for myself, when actually, though, the more was more for their patients or for their students or for their work. And their defense would say, look, I haven't hardly even gone to the bathroom today. I have really haven't done anything for myself. So this is why I just need this alone time. And the family members will get it because they find the individual so different after that piece or whatever it might be. So that's one thing that really helps. The other is to not come home on empty. Now, of course, after being on call or a very busy week or something, that's when the family just sort of has to understand that mom or dad, when they come in the back door, they are kind of used up. There ain't much in the tank. So those could be evenings where there's not going to be a huge amount of family interaction or whatever. But if that's not happening all the time, they'll be fine. They just realize that at this particular time, they're really not available. As I said, the tank is dry.
Yeah.
But then once that period of time occurs, it's very important to make sure your pager's turned off, your cell phone is turned off, that when you attempt to talk, the TV isn't there, that there are distractions. And when I prescribe homework to couples, that they have to find that sweet spot where they can actually have time. And even in some couples who have young kids, they need to, in a sense, tell those kids that mommy and daddy are having grown-up time right now. You cannot come into the kitchen or into the living room for the next 30 minutes while you either do your homework or whatever that might be, that this time now is off limits. That's a wonderful model because they
in my house, that would last 5 seconds before they, I forgot. You know,
I know.
I'm injured. I'm whatever it happens to be. Yeah.
Believe it or not, they can be trained.
Yeah. It'll just take some time and some effort, but you can.
It takes some time. And in the long run, they will really like that. They will see that mommy and daddy are having big people time or time for themselves.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. That gives them a chance even to kind of review their days and, you know, what's happened at their respective workplaces, or if the spouse's workplace is the home, because they're the CEO of the home and doing all the labor and all that sort of stuff. That's very important. That be communicated as well. So, and this is where things like alcohol, you have to be careful about how much that could be interfering. You know, I've talked with couples that say, I like it when my husband does that, but I don't mind if he has a glass of wine, to unwind, but if he has a martini, it's not quite the same. He's in a good mood, but
He's not as engaged. Yeah.
He's not engaged.
Yeah. And that gets used to that substance use point, right? It doesn't have to be substance abuse.
Sure.
Just substance use. And that needs to be
communicated.
But I could see a situation where the spouse says, listen, I've noticed this difference.
Yeah.
And the physician's reaction is defensiveness.
Yes.
Right? And rationalization.
That's true. The other thing I wanted to explain to you, too, is the importance of couples dating each other, especially when they have young kids. So I used to want them to have a date once a week, but that was a bit too tough for couples. And especially if there's some economic challenges, but every 2 weeks, they have to have a date with each other. So that means getting a babysitter. And even couples who are strapped for money would pay the babysitter and really just maybe go for a walk, sit on a park bench with, you know, a Starbucks coffee or something. But many couples will say we have our best talks when we're outside the home and there's no interruptions, or if we're in motion, you know, like if we go for a run together, if they're running beside each other, if we go for a bike ride, they got to make sure they're beside each other and not in tandem.
Yeah.
Type of thing.
The reason I laugh, I'm not laughing at the advice. I'm just laughing. You said without interruption, because that is right. The kids always end up, you know, where there's a gravitational pull towards the parents, at least now, right? When my kids are 6, 8, and 9. And so, you know, in a couple of years, the gravitational pull will switch polarity and it'll be in the other, they'll be repelled by us.
Yes.
But for the time being, it's really, we have to be physically in a different place in order to have that time.
And Brad, those are the years when kids are that age that are most challenging for the parents, because there really isn't a lot of time left for either each of you as individuals or for the two of you as a couple. So that's why you really have to fight for it or protect it. And that's where having, you know, grandparents or babysitters or whatever helps to free you up for just that period so that you can remain in touch with each other. You know, that you don't lose sight, because it's not a good thing if the two individuals kind of, because I've heard this, especially from wives that say, we communicate, but now we just communicate as co-parents.
Yeah.
Which is important.
Or co-workers or partners, but not partners.
Yes. Then, of course, when and if they can get away for an overnight somewhere. I know couples who will go and stay in a hotel one night on the weekend if they can get childcare. And it's heaven. I mean, it just feels wonderful to be able to wake up or maybe sleep in.
Yes. Sleep in. Yeah. You know, I'm on Long Island where they have advertisements for the Comac Motor Inn. I think they even, you can get the hotel room by the hour. Just kidding. There's not an ad for that place. Yeah. I'm sure it's lovely. If you like this podcast episode, you're going to love the other shows over at the Doctor Podcast Network. For instance, Doctors Making a Difference. Be inspired by Dr. Peter Crane of Doctors Making a Difference. Discover stories of physicians who are transforming lives and communities. Celebrate the impact of medicine beyond the clinic. Listen and subscribe to be part of the movement. So, okay, so we've talked about making sure that you have time with just each other, uninterrupted time, whether it's a date night every other weekend, whether it's an overnight, or even just separating yourselves physically and telling the children that you need uninterrupted time to make sure that you have time. And when you get home from work, having some buffer between when work ends and when home begins so that you can have that mental transition. And so what that assumes is there is some time there. But we have this culture of overwork, right? Where we may rationalize overworking ourselves to the detriment of our family responsibilities because we feel like we have the institution requires it, the patients require it. Or you're doing it in order to make money for your family, right? There's a financial need. So how do we know if we've like crossed the line, right? And we are now rationalizing the decision to overwork because it's been ingrained in us.
Yeah, that's such a good question, because it depends, of course, on the branch of medicine. It also depends on the culture of the workplace. As you know, there are workplaces now that are so sensitive to, or they're giving so much thought to physicians' personal life and lifestyle that they're building in sabbaticals, for instance, or they're making sure that everybody gets only so much on call.
Yeah.
Or there's this or that or whatever. So it's a recognition that look at, we all have lives outside of work. Yes, we're dedicated professionals, but we have to realize that we're also human.
While we're there, because you and I are physicians of a different generation, so what would you say to the physicians of your generation that would say to my generation, that's because we're just not dedicated enough? And it used to be a calling, but now it's a job, and you guys are just clocking it in and you're not dedicated to your patients. I know that we're going off topic here.
No, mind going off topic, because in a sense, the problem with that, and I've said this to my peers, if you're going to complain like that about the next generation of physicians, then by all means, disclose to them the price you've paid. Like, how many marriages have you had? Have you struggled with alcoholism? Have you worried that a couple of your adult children have disappointed you because of the fact that you gave your life to medicine? And yes, your students loved you, your residents loved you, you won awards, but you were embarrassed to talk about your home life. It's very important, if you're going to complain about the next generation, that you be transparent.
Excellent point. So then how do we fall into what you've recommended and not what you just discussed, right? How do we avoid that, rationalizing the overall?
So where I was going with that is, if we kind of look at a bit of our peers who are in the same branch of medicine, and also see what we can do to kind of have more integration or balance in our lives. And by the way, some of this comes from our own families of origin, because there are many very thoughtful practicing physicians today who say that, look, I have to do this differently because I don't like the way I grew up. I grew up lonely. I wanted more time with my dad or my mom or both or something like that. So I'm going to try to, tailor this. Also, what I'm doing is, I've already accepted the fact that my earnings aren't going to be as high as perhaps my father's were or something like that, because I want something different in my life or for my family. And so if that kind of talk gets incorporated into your own marriage and family, then that helps too, because then you get away from this worry about, being the breadwinner and having to provide all this stuff. And I lost count of the number of times when my kids were small that said, well, Daddy, so-and-so's father is a psychiatrist, and how come they go to Hawaii every year and we don't? Or something like that. I had to explain that even though we're in the same branch of medicine, I think we do things differently in our home, perhaps, than what they do in their home, or something like that. Or in it all.
Yeah.
Trust me, I don't think my kids ended up feeling they were in the poorhouse.
Yeah.
But they sometimes just need that education.
Yeah. I mean, it's diminishing returns, right? Yes. The more money you make, the less of a difference it makes, in your life. But then the trade-off is the less time with your family. And so the couple more hours a week of work is a bit more income, but at the same time, that's a lot less time with your family. And so you need to recognize that that's what you're doing. Also, we do have different phases in our life where, when the kids are small, they require more of attention. When they're a little older, they need us to shuttle them places. And then when they're even older, they need us less. And so we can,
That's right. The thing I want to add to that is how important it is that when I was seeing couples in therapy, they realized that this was something that they were taking time out for each other. And I told them that I want them to see that this is something that they're doing because they care about each other, the preservation or improvement in the marriage, and also the wholesomeness of the family. And so many people with that kind of thinking realize that, okay, so I'm going to leave work at 4 o'clock on Thursday afternoon, go see someone about this. And then sometimes they would expand after they left my office to go out for dinner together or something like that. That way then everything we had talked about was very fresh. And so that felt like a very special sort of afternoon of the week or something like that, as they're laying down sort of different principles and ways of trying to figure out how we can just have more balance for all of us. Because you have to have time together in order for things to remain of interest. This is how people get bored with each other.
What if we're escaping into work, right? What if we're using work
Yes.
To avoid, towards the beginning when my kids were really young, I had spoken to a therapist. And one of the things I said was, when I get home from work, like, I know when it's time for bedtime, I know what I need to do. I know how to do bedtime, right? Do bath, we read a book, we change, we get into pajamas. Like, I know the routine. But when I get home earlier, I'm not sure what to do. Now, looking back on it, what the heck was wrong with me? Right? Like, I had a little babies there. I could have been playing with the little babies, but I, like, you know, I had my list of things that I needed to do. And if it wasn't on the list of things to do, then I was like kind of at a loss.
Yes.
And so it's not exactly the same thing. But if we are staying at work later in order to avoid home life, how do we know if that's what we're doing?
I've got two thoughts about that. First of all, I think the first one is to pay attention to people who love us and care about us, that they think that's what we're doing in some way. Even if we react defensively, you know, where we say, well, no, I'm just trying to get caught up in my charting. I'm not having an affair or anything like that.
Having an affair with Epic.
Yes, exactly. That's right. That sort of thing. So to listen to, and also sometimes get their guidance that actually it is okay to leave earlier. And somehow you will get that done. And you may even get it done more efficiently if you're rested or something like that. Or even if it sits, that's okay. But we're so programmed in medicine to be efficient and to get things done and to kind of clean the slate, to do this and do that and do that. So the other way you can tell is if, for instance, things are getting kind of heated and there's a sort of sense that, look, if we keep this up, I think this is going to break out into a fight or something like that. And then your pager goes off because you're on call. You get called back to the hospital and you're driving to the hospital and you're feeling, thank God. So thank God I was able to get out of the house, go to do something noble, you know, to not having to deal with something that I don't feel very skilled at. And I heard that from lots of doctors. They say, Dr. Myers, can you help just with basic communication so that, you know, I won't have to turn to the liquor chest or something, or I won't have to do this, I won't have to do that. And there are things, you know, apart from what I can suggest as a marital therapist, professional psychiatrist, there are so many things out there that are available, like in terms of marital enrichment, weekends. People who are religiously affiliated, sometimes there are things that are offered through their house of worship. There's marital retreats. You know, there's stuff that's available for people to help them sort of with the ABCs. Often some of the things I would say to them is say to just accept that this is a little bit difficult, but just try to relax.
You've done hard things before. You trained to do this. That was really hard. And now you're good at it. You've mastered it. This is something else that you should be trying to master in the same way.
That's right.
This was the end of part one, so make sure you stay tuned to next week for part two. Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means either you fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please write us a 5-star review, take a screenshot, and email it to me so I can send you a quick guide on how to earn patient trust in 20 seconds or less. Email me at brad@physiciansguidetodoctoring.com and feel free to suggest a topic or guest. I take your requests seriously. The views expressed on this episode are those of the interviewer and the interviewee and do not represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting makes it sound like I'm talking directly to you, this is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice or financial advice or legal advice or really any advice. Thanks again for listening to Succeed in Medicine.